Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the back half of the New Statesman's Culture Podcast with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
And Kate, I just want to ask you about this briefly because you've just come in from a little assignment, haven't you?
I've been trying to penetrate the Fort Knox that is the Hamilton press team for the last, like, feels like 10 years. But when we went to see it in February, I think we spoke about the fact that the person playing Aaron Burr, who is obviously the anti-hero, fantastic yes. part, was the one that really stood out to me from the cast that night. And I went home and I like flicked through the programme. Who is this man? And I thought, it wasn't that man. And it was the understudy.
Yeah.
So I thought, wow, I want to find out more about the life of an understudy. So I finally went to see him this morning. His name is Sifiso Mazibuko, a South African actor. And I discovered today that he is not only the understudy for Aaron Burr, but also for Hamilton himself and Lafayette. So when he took this role on, they said to him, there might be a couple of other parts as well. And then he found out they were Hamilton Lafayette. So I was just talking to him about the sheer mental feat, really, of learning three parts. He's been on 30 times now as Burr, but he's never been on as Hamilton. And he was fascinating. He was telling me that the way that he learnt the three roles was by colour coding them in his mind. So he associated the colour green, I think, with Hamilton, orange with Burr, and Lafayette was a kind of a sort of purple colour. And he sort of blocked himself on stage in his mind with these colours. And also he said that when understudies learn their parts, they go to rehearsals. They don't obviously go on stage. They sit there in the audience watching the rehearsal. And then they get up and they sort of mirror the movements of the actors on stage at the back of the auditorium. So at any one time.
So it's like this odd shadow.
A shadowing play
going on.
Wow. Going on near the fire exits and at the back of the chairs. And it was really interesting because it's the combination of the mental agility that you must have to do those three different roles in your head and also not being able to go on and do them.
Yeah.
So the juxtaposition of the tension of the fact that you're not on stage every night versus the fact that you can be and that you can pull that out your sleeve.
And he was so assured and so compelling that I couldn't, you know, of course, I mean, understudies, they must hire really good actors to be understudies. It makes sense. They're not going to be like the C team. They're going to be really good. But when we saw him, he was, as I say, so assured that I couldn't quite believe it was the understudy. I mean, he's only got to notch up, you know, he only has to learn a couple of the others before he could almost pretty much do a one-man
show. He could do the one-man show. A one-man review going around in a van. And I asked him whether he ever actually has decided, you know, tried to act out the songs that take place between Burr and Hamilton just for larks, like in a mirror or switching around cartoon style and playing both parts. And he says that he does one in his head and says the other one out loud, and that's the way he does it. I would say go and see him, but there's no way of knowing when he'll be on. Just go every night and then maybe one of those nights.
Getting into Hamilton in itself is quite an achievement. Who you see is, I think.
Even getting to stage door was quite an achievement. So people radioing ahead and Kate is here. okay. I won't try again.
We spent yesterday in a lovely cinematic double bill watching Wonderstruck, which is Todd Haynes' new film, and A Quiet Place, which is a new horror film directed by and starring John Krasinski. So we're going to talk about that in just a moment. And we will also have our soon-to-be-revealed non-iversary, which is it's a good one this week.
It is.
I've spent a valuable 6 minutes on YouTube revising for it just before we came down. So stay tuned.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So we drew a not-so-tenuous link between two movies for our movie marathon yesterday, for A Quiet Place and Wonderstruck. The theme of deafness, hearing,
yeah,
silence. And both these films kind of united in one of the lead actresses, Millicent Simmons, who is a 14, 15-year-old girl from Utah who lost her hearing at the age of 12 from a medication overdose, and has been cast in both these films and plots her own kind of unique path through them. And it's like basically Wonderstruck and Quiet Place, two things you associate with noise: horror and New York City, and noise is the thing that is removed from them. So you read the book that Wonderstruck was based on.
I haven't read the book, actually. I've read I read another book by Brian Selznick, The Invention of Hugo Cabret, although read is a slightly, is the wrong word for it really, because The Invention of Hugo Cabret is a wordless graphic novel, effectively. So it's just pure pictures all the way through. Brian Selznick is an amazing artist, and he does these very detailed, kind of cross-hatched line pencil drawings. And The Invention of Hugo Cabret was picked up and turned into a film by Martin Scorsese. It's a story...
Hugo, right?
Yeah.
Was it called Hugo? The film was Hugo.
The film... Was it just called
yeah,
Hugo?
I think so.
Okay, yeah. They just decided that there were too many words for people.
It's too complicated.
What? Invent cabaret? What do you mean? Cabaret? You're right. Hugo, which was kind of rendered in this sort of really richly kind of semi-animated 3D 1930s Paris for the film. And this book, Wonderstruck, is illustrated as well, but it also has text. It's a slightly older, it's kind of young adult novel, and this has been picked up by Todd Haynes and turned into a movie. It is a split narrative, so it's half set in 1977, begins in 1977 in Minnesota, is it?
Mm.
Yeah. And then the other part of the film is 1927, beginning in New Jersey, and really the plot moves those two narratives together. The 1977 narrative has a young boy, Ben, played by Oakes Fegley, whose mother has been killed in a car crash, is being raised by his aunt. This is something that a sort of continuum in Brian Selznick's work, Hugo Cabret is an orphan as well. And the 1927 narrative has Millicent Simmons, who you just described, this young deaf girl playing a deaf girl, growing up in New Jersey with a very strict father who looks like a sort of angry T.S. Eliot. He's kind of got these, he's sort of amazing looking. He's got these thick black circular spectacles and slick back hair, kind of almost, you know, fashion that you see occasionally in Dalston now.
The Chap Olympics.
The Chap Olympics.
With very amazingly, every time the film cuts to its black and white silent movie incarnation with Millicent in it, it's kind of beautiful because all the actions are so exaggerated.
Yes.
So there is kind of a story of silent movies within the silent movie, because she's chasing a famous matinee actress that she loves and wants to find. But it's even like the film itself is shot in this kind of slightly comical fashion. I thought it was a beautiful idea, taking two deaf kids in New York City. I mean, there's something very uncinematic about that, in a sense, isn't there? As I say, a place of noise and chaos. And just looking at the shock, the sensory shock, but the lack of sound surrounding two kids trying to navigate their way through Manhattan.
Yeah, so just to fill in, the end of that was going to be that Ben is, he's a hearing kid, but he has an accident and is struck deaf. So that's the thing that connects them. And they both end up in New York City trying to pursue elusive characters. And Ben's looking for his father, and Millicent Simmons, who plays her character's called Rose, she's looking for her mother. But yeah, as you said, one of the things I loved about this film is that the 1927 part has this lovely silent movie feel to it. I mean, you do see Rose sits down and watches a silent movie partway through it. And the kind of silent movie soundtrack of piano, like dramatic piano rolls and stabs and things, start to accentuate the world in which she's living in. So, you know, when her father slams his fist down on the table, you get that brilliant kind of piano stab. And in both narratives as well, I think another thing I think that Todd Haynes does really well is just show you things from a child's point of view. I loved all the kind of the crowd scenes where you're getting things at kind of waist level. So in the 20s, you're getting lots of like stockings and seas of hats. And in the 70s, you're getting loads of bare torsos.
And amazing and jeans.
Amazing tight jeans. I say halfway through this, I was kind of wondering, everyone in the 70s stands in a really bizarre way, but you pointed out that it's just because their jeans are so tight. They're all sort of leaning on cars.
Yeah. And they play in like fire hydrants. Yeah. And it is, I just thought it was really enchanting. It's really slow and really odd, and it has its flaws, which we will come to, but it is dreamlike. And I was trying to think about what I felt about it today. And it is a bit like a thing that you watched half awake, or slightly stoned, or that you dreamt, because even though he doesn't have much in the way of dialogue to play with, there is a lot of sound in a funny kind of way. Whenever the little boy Ben steps out onto the street, you get this amazing like whacka whacka funk bass, and it is saying this is 1977, but it's doing it in a way that is artistic rather than just trying to kind of set the scene or something like that. It becomes the whole point. Like that bass and those jeans become the whole point of that scene, because he's got no one to talk to. He's lost his hearing. You know, it's about a feeling. It creates amazing feelings, but it's very hard to kind of pin down exactly whether or not it works as a piece of cinema.
I think you're right. The sound is really effective. The visuals are really effective. It moves between the two narratives have their own sort of soundscapes. And in Ben's sound world, what you get is you get all the kind of atmospheric noise that you and I as hearing people have all the time. And then he'll just turn it off. So then you just get this very, very kind of very faint buzz that Ben's hearing. And the kind of dislocating effect of that is really nicely done. And the sound worlds of the two kind of start to merge into each other. The visual, perhaps this is getting a bit technical, but the visual links between the two, I think, were a bit less subtly done. So it's kind of like one of them makes a paper boat and sticks it on a lake, and then it sort of cuts to a boat a random boat in Ben's world. So he's done this kind of, you know, he's tried to match objects between the two worlds, which kind of didn't always work for me.
We should say a lot of the action of the film as well, if you could call it action, takes place in the Natural History Museum in Central Park, off Central Park, which both children go to in their own worlds. And they look at the same dioramas and the same meteorites, and basically a story develops from that. But that in itself is it's an odd concept. I mean, it's kind of stubbornly old-fashioned in a way to recall a time when the idea of, the museum was the epicenter of childlike wonder or something. Yeah. I mean, when you're 3 years old, you go and see the dinosaurs and they're fascinating, but you don't get children standing in front of stuffed antelopes going, wow, this is amazing. You just don't. I was in that museum a month ago and I was like, wow, these things look like they haven't been changed since the 20s, which was maybe the point of this film.
And they're also weirdly uncinematic things to put at the center of your film. And I think he does the best he can to kind of, the title is Wonderstruck. It's the title of a book which is within the story, which is written about. Oh, is Wonderstruck the title of the book? It is. Yeah, it's a book about kind of the history of collecting and of museums.
Cabinets of Curiosity.
Yeah, exactly. And Todd Haynes does his best to recreate that scene of wonder. And there is a lovely sequence showing the Natural History Museum dioramas where you get the animals quite up close and you get this kind of interesting like depth of field. So you feel like the wolves really are in the foreground and the kind of snowy background recedes into the distance. But generally it is quite a tough act to pull off. The other tough act to pull off is how you unpick a very complicated plot using exposition through deaf and speaking people.
There's one three-way conversation between someone who's deaf but can't sign, someone who can sign but can't speak, and someone who can do both. But that, for me, that was one of the things that I really liked about it, because once you had submitted to the fact that it was a really, really weird film, you could be patient enough to watch these epic scenes unfold of people writing bits, instructions down for each other on paper and showing them a notepad. And then, you know, not wanting to spoil any plots, but there is a long scene at the end where someone has taken a long time to
Julianne
write something.
Moore is
she's written 20 pages on a notepad, right?
Julianne Moore, who's been in Todd Haynes' films before, in this one, imagine if he sort of, mainly what you're going to be doing is writing in a notepad and someone else is going to read out. Is that okay? Yeah, that's great, Todd. Thanks.
Did you remember things like, did you ever see Eyes Wide Shut?
I haven't seen that, actually.
Or as my friend calls it, Legs Wide Shut. it's so slow that it washes over you once you accept it. And in a way, I can imagine watching this again and again, not expecting an exciting film from it, but just expecting a feeling or something.
Yeah. I think I was thinking about his other films and I haven't seen enough of them, but Carol, which came out in 2015 or 2016, I forget, amazing story based on a Patricia Highsmith novel, and Mildred Pierce, which was his version he did for HBO of an older movie starring Joan Crawford. They do have this kind of really, they do share a really nicely kind of controlled visual style. He's tried to do something a lot kind of wilder in this, in a way, and you know it hasn't all worked, but you know it's to be applauded for its ambition.
It's also coincidentally or otherwise, it really plays into the aesthetic that we all love at the moment, which is retro children in stripy t-shirts and corduroys finding weird warps in time and being wonderstruck because you know it's got feelings of E.T., it's got lots of feelings of Stranger Things. And both, references to nights at the museum.
Yeah, and both the child actors are really compelling, aren't they? They both just have incredibly compelling faces.
Bizarre faces.
Yeah.
Yeah. Little kind of beaten up looking kids.
Yeah. Really sort of thoughtful but quite sort of cute and appealing as well. Like, yeah, they're
sort of sulky but thoughtful. Yeah. Yeah, I felt that just as a kind of segue to our other film as well, that in both these cases, the children have been selected on their very unusual vibes and their unusual faces in A Quiet Place, as we'll go on to discuss. It's not your classic horror film kids who are like, mommy, daddy, that sort of, you know, perfect all-American family, in the way the adults are much more conventional and it's the children that are strange. And I think that's kind of a nice thing that we're seeing at the moment in cinema. We like those weird faces. We like the strange eyebrows and the strange crumply smiles. And
yeah. So A Quiet Place...
From the sublime to the...
A Quiet Place, directed by John Krasinski, who you may know from The American Office. Are you a fan of The American Office?
I haven't seen it.
Have you not?
No.
The American Office is... I kind of often recommend The American Office to people because I feel like British people have quite rightly probably an inherent resistance to it. Because yeah. The Office, although everyone... It's hard to remember this now that everyone sort of hates Ricky Gervais now.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
The Office was kind of hugely loved and was brilliant and quite kind of daring. And The American Office is much kinder, much more American. The David Brent character is quite lovable in a way. But they've turned it into a kind of a show that can run and run, whereas the British Office had to kind of shut itself down quite quickly. But John Krasinski plays one of the main characters in that. He's been in quite a few films as well and directed a couple of indie films. So this is his first major film. And in the casting process, he looked far and wide and found himself and his wife, amazingly. So he and Emily Blunt star...
One of my main problems with the film was that I thought, oh, that couple's not convincing at all. I didn't know that they were a couple.
Man and wife. So the premise of this film is a really good premise. It is an America in which, this is totally really unexplained how any of this happens, but monsters have taken over. And the way these monsters operate is they operate purely on sound. So if you make a noise, they will get you, basically. They'll suddenly appear screaming out of the undergrowth and gobble you up. And John Krasinski and Emily Blunt play this couple. They've got three kids and she is pregnant with their fourth child. And they're trying to survive. They seem to be the only family that has survived.
There's an old man at some point, isn't
there? Yeah. But one of their kids is actually deaf, which is where the brilliant Millicent Simmons comes in.
So this is basically a family that need to exist by not speaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And wearing no shoes.
Yeah.
And creeping around.
And scattering sand everywhere.
Do they scatter sand?
Yeah. Did you not notice that they made pathways in all their fields and stuff with trails of sand? I guess... That would have a dual function. It would make the passage of their feet on the sand much more pleasant, and B, it would reduce noise. So yeah, their whole setup is created to extinguish noise. So John Krasinski is a sensitive, soulful father, but is also very, very resourceful. So he's built himself a CCTV station to keep a lookout on the monsters, and he has also kind of adapted their home in various ways to try and soundproof it.
He has a kind of elaborate soldering workshop in the basement where he's working on hearing aids.
He's
for
trying
his
to
daughter.
Make a hearing aid for his daughter. Yeah.
But at the same time, it's one of those films that you cannot help but pick apart the plot. It just keeps coming up with, hang on, if they're doing that, why aren't they doing that type problems? So they do indeed have a bunker underneath the house, which they are kind of, in a very rudimentary way, papering with newspaper to try and make it soundproof. But above that, he has his soldering workshop with all his high-tech equipment, and he has his satellites and everything like that. So there are scenes where, for instance, you know, lovely ideas, like if you are near something where the sound is larger, you can make a sound that's smaller and you won't be heard by these horrible creatures. So he takes his son to a waterfall. And they actually have a proper conversation. It's one of the few conversations in the film. And you can't help but thinking, why don't they just live there? Come on.
Well, it would be a bit damp. It'd
be fine. Look, how would he build a baby and puts it in a bucket in a flooded basement.
How would he build his CCTV workstation?
That's true.
Behind the
he couldn't off. Make his hearing aids there. My real problem with this film was that I really, really like horror as a genre. And the thing I hate about horror is the way it uses sound so cheaply. The way of watching a horror film, if you don't want to be frightened, I realised a few years ago, is you just plug your ears. Then you can see anything on screen. Doesn't matter how horrible it is, you don't get shocks. Because all they're doing is throwing in extremely loud noises whenever anyone comes around a corner or whenever a hand grabs your arm or anything like that. And I thought, okay, this is a film that's going to look at that problem and subvert it and do something with silence. It doesn't. Every single shock in this film relies on extreme amounts of Dolby surround sound to give you a shock in exactly the same way that all other horror does. Mm. And it was, I just thought, what's the point? Like, what's the point of looking at the idea of silence in a horror film if you're still going to have somebody, like, you know, grabbing someone's arm and there's this massive jolt and the whole cinema shakes. And I just got really pissed off.
Well, I have to say, I know that you are a fan of horror. And this is the first horror film I've watched with you. I was kind of, you had your hands in your ears for most
That's
of it.
Why. So I said, if you go and watch Halloween from the 70s, so silent.
Right.
Amazing John Carpenter music. Yeah. Basically long shots of someone walking really slowly. And dark and weird and just like it's all about the fright is there in the storyline, whereas in this, I mean, I didn't care whether Emily Blunt got eaten.
That's so harsh. I have to say, I'm really, you know, Farmer Blunt, when she appears in her in her denim dungarees, you know, she's a great mom. I thought she was all right, actually. And I agree with you that they didn't manage to communicate their real life chemistry as well as they could have done, despite sharing an iPod listening to Harvest Moon and sort of shuffling around, sort of vaguely encircling her bump, which is, you know, we've all done it. No, I agree with you. And I think it was a bit of a missed opportunity with the sound in general, because, you know, what he decided to do in the end was actually, even though I didn't mind the kind of shock, the horror shock sound effects as much as you did, what did annoy me was the fact that in the bits where we weren't having our shocks, we had just soupy strings the whole time.
Yeah.
So there wasn't really, for a film that trades in silence, there was very, very little silence. And I just read an interview where this was put to him, and he said...
Did you say whoops?
He said, oh yeah, good point. He said that he wanted the audience to feel like they were in a familiar film world. It's the same way a lot of Hollywood films are overscored. They're just nervous of the audience getting uncomfortable and you know, coming out of themselves and thinking about the fact they're sitting in a cinema watching a film. So the braver thing to do would have been to strip out some of this sound and to kind of explore the idea of silence. They didn't go down that road.
My other problem with them is always, again, you can get such a great concept for a film and then the actual evil force, the alien, is just literally pulled out of a prop cupboard, and it's been in a million other films. So you had here the sort of these strange creatures that had highly developed hearing and no eyes, but loads and loads of layers of teeth, just like the ones we've seen in Stranger Things and Alien. Weird stock sound that they all make, which you just feel has been just taken off some CD that's been knocking around for 30 years in horror, where they make a dinosaur type roar and then they shriek at the same time, and then there's a loud thud and stuff. Mm. And I always think, like, why do they stop creatively at the point where they invent the beast? Why don't they do something that looks different? Why are they always these scaly kind of... I mean, my interest goes immediately as soon as I see that it's some like weird scaly alien thing with loads of teeth.
I think that
it could have been humans.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it is quite rare to see. You're right. It is quite rare to see a genuinely original and scary monster. I mean, the ones I think of are like the one I always think of is the one in Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah,
where he's got eyes in the palm of his hands.
Yeah,
that's one of the most terrifying monsters I think I've ever seen. Our colleague Helen Lewis's piece recently on Annihilation, and that's the film we talked about. I talked about with Helen on the last podcast. She's talking to Adam Rutherford, who's a sort of science consultant on lots of films, and he says that directors often come to him and say, like, make me an alien I've never seen before. And he basically said, to counter your complaint there, he basically said you can't, because everything's been sort of done before, and you can't really come up with a new alien.
Wow. But I'll never forget my disappointment in Jeepers Creepers, which is a great horror film, when this thing that you think is just a redneck guy with a gun ends up like a scaly leg comes out the bottom of his trousers, and then some wings emerge and says, oh, okay, you know, it's one of those films. And so many people I've spoken to got the same deep disappointment when the alien came out of the man's costume. People love it, though.
You've ruined Jeepers Creepers for me now. That's been on my list for so long, and now I'm not going to bother. I think the aliens do have one cool feature, which is the kind of expanding, like, whirl-like earpiece. And I think the strengths of the film are it's kind of focused very tightly on its premise, so it's quite kind of... it's quite tightly made in a way, isn't it? It's not baggy. It's focused, and the set pieces, I think, despite the complaint about the sound, the set pieces are well done. You know, like there's a scene with a nail, and they take a kind of small tightly focused object or danger situation and make a lot of it. There's a birth scene which I'm not going to describe, but it does.
Farmer Blunt does well.
She gets a gold star, and all the NCT sessions really worked out for her.
I like the sort of return in this, and also in Interstellar, you had it sort of a Dust Bowl feeling to this post-apocalyptic or post-aggressed world, because you got endless wheat fields. It's a very fecund kind of landscape, but there's no one on it. There's no one to tend it. And you've got a family in shoes with rolled up trousers, and a lovely kind of attention to the kind of clothes that you would, with the exception of Farmer Blunt's dungarees, the kind of clothes that you would wear if you didn't really have any clothes. I love the fact that Millicent Simmons wears, you know, she's wearing sort of leggings under skirts and sort of strange wetsuit top, like thrown on top. And they're just that great feeling of, this is actually how a family would look if they had to start again and constantly be moving on as well.
You're right. And often in these kind of slightly post-apocalyptic setups, the landscape is barren and blasted. And so it's nice. It's nice that it's a nice contrast to the sort of terror of their situation, that actually it's not a problem that they, you know, they're not struggling for food or anything. It's all...
I wonder who's farming,
it's
though.
All there. Well, I wondered if they were supposed to be farmers previously, because
That's another little kind of plot hole, is that they can't wear shoes, but they can drive cars.
No, they only drove a car once, I think, in a situation of high danger. I think it's, if we're asked what it's about, because I think it is a film that aspires to having a little bit of a meaning. I think it's probably the sort of the terror of parenthood, and the key line, you know, the script isn't amazing, but the key line, I think, comes from Farmer Blunt. She says, "Who are we if we can't protect them?" So it's kind of about the terror of being responsible for children and having to protect them from.
So
from
that
the
again,
world.
It's very tight. It's very. It's a small focus in a way, isn't it? The same way you never find out why this has happened and what's happened to this world, really.
Krasinski did say that there's another resonance to the theme of the movie. He said, "I think in our political situation that what's going on now, you can close your eyes and stick your head in the sand, or you can try to participate in whatever's going on."
Oh.
Which I thought was a bit less convincing. You've sort of made that up afterwards, haven't you? That it's about silence and putting your head in the sand and Trump. I wasn't so convinced by that.
No.
And also I wasn't, I'm sure I would have done no better, but I wasn't convinced by his action man running through cornfields.
I thought a lot of the family setup was very sort of unreconstructed. And I kind of like that about it, because I was wondering whether it's sort of making a point about roles in that sense, you know, because he that's, you know, I'm not going to spoil the plot, but you do see his fallibility.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's very quickly stepped into this kind of American dad role, and Millicent Simmons has to stay at home and prepare the fish while the boy goes out with him and stuff. Yeah. But those roles are questioned all the way through. So I think it is quite sort of advanced in that sense, but it just looks at first like your bog standard American horror setup.
Yeah. Just very briefly, the one thing these two films have in common is just how good the child actors are. And we talked a bit about Millicent Simmons already, but they're really like put through their paces, because they're basically their whole scenes where they just have to emote, furiously emote, you know.
But maybe maybe the reason for that is actually that as we get older, we become much more self-conscious about using our facial muscles, and children are just much more rubbery and expressive.
But the young kid who's genuinely terrified, I found totally convincing. Like, he really was utterly kind of frozen with fear.
Whereas there were points where I sort of thought that Emily Blunt's face looked like she was trying not to laugh. And I know that's not true, but it sort of made me laugh, because it was something very poised about it, you know, very graceful and very poised.
Was that when she did have a few light, she had a couple of light moments. She had a scene where she was teaching her son long division.
And she did a toothless granny impression, which was great.
So
that's my favourite bit.
So both these films are on release now, I think.
And on Friday, I think.
I realise it's highly unlikely, but I do think they make quite a good double bill.
I don't think we'll be seeing them as a double bill in any cinemas anytime soon.
In my cinema, I will show them as a double
bill. So, Tom, after a lot of research, we've found another non-iversary, which is our non-specific, unimportant, cultural marker. What do we have this week?
Well, this week it's 27 years since Do the Bartman, the Simpsons spin-off single, spent its 12th and last week in the UK Top 100 music chart.
So it's the very last week. So it disappeared after this point 27 years ago.
So it's 12 weeks in the chart, 2 or 3 weeks at number one. And, well, you must remember it, do you?
I did have it.
Yeah.
You bought on the disc.
Yeah.
On a vinyl.
On a vinyl disc.
Waxing.
Wow.
What about you?
I don't think I owned it, but it was always present at kind of birthday parties and at friends' houses, and the cassette and the album later, Simpsons Sing the Blues, that it was included on. Listening to it again, it's actually sort of not too annoying. It's kind of, I think it might be one of the few sort of novelty songs I can think of that is actually vaguely listenable.
I wondered if I had the right song, because I was looking through YouTube and I think I had the right song, but it was basically a kind of slick, sophisticated rap song without much of a tune.
Yeah.
And some good harmonies by Michael Jackson
and
in the background.
Some nice slidey bass in there. Yeah.
I mean, a very kind of sophisticated piece of music.
It's an extremely sophisticated piece of music, Kate. And there's a bit of an argument about who's responsible for the music, because the songwriter is Brian Lauren, who you know of. I didn't know of
Brian
him.
The Wiz Hudson. I don't know of him. I just found out about him.
Oh, I thought you were like a big fan. I thought he was a kind of Bruce Hornsby type character in your life.
No, but it enabled us to have a debate very quickly, because you said, you know, it's believed that Michael Jackson actually wrote this song. I said, no, it was Brian the Wiz Hudson.
So Jackson did get in touch with the show offering to write a song, and apparently came up with the title. But then how much he actually contributed beyond the title and doing the backing vocals is up for debate. Brian Loren said that he just did the backing vocals, gave him the title, and said that the song had to mention Michael Jackson, which it does.
Amazing, which it does.
And it also has a quite a cool sort of Jackson-inspired dance routine towards the end.
It's just a nostalgic snapshot of the very early Simpsons, isn't it? Where actually Bart was the naughty boy and it was all about him, and Marge and Homer hadn't necessarily emerged to be the complex characters they now are. So it was like Bart's putting mothballs in their soup and everyone's annoyed at the naughty boys.
That's the line I really remembered, putting mothballs in the meat stew. I
mean,
I
just thought
that was
really
funny. Yeah. It's hilarious. The height of wit. Yeah, it didn't have any of that kind of existential I guess it was before like Homer's sayings were on coasters and bumper stickers and t-shirts around.
Because it was only 2 years old, wasn't it, the programme?
Yeah, so the programme started in 89 and this they released the single in 1990 and it came into the UK chart in 91. It does have some of the wit of The Simpsons, like the video opens with a really staid school performance where they're doing this kind of, the kids are doing this awful sort of choreographed dance and they're announced with, and now for a group that needs no introduction, your children, to all the parents.
I had a plastic Bart which I just remembered I bought off the back of this song. So I had like a kind of, it had a soft butt with, you know, soft butt and then really hard head with the plastic hair. And I just remember how much it hurt when my brother hit my head with Bart's head because it had this, it was like a meat tenderizer. Yes. That's what it was like. It's really hard. So that's my memory of this song.
Please write in with your pictures of your Simpsons memorabilia. I wonder if any of them are worth anything now. Probably not. That was probably so mass-produced. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. Do go on iTunes and review us and rate us and get in touch and send us non-anniversary suggestions. The current issue of The New Statesman contains a review by Ryan Gilbey of Wonderstruck, one of the films we've been talking about today. It's also got a great Spring Books special with lots of reviews in there. We have been edited by Caroline Crampton and we're going to leave you with
our house band, Pistol Jazz, and their song Godspeed.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.